why are you all interested in that very same toy? There's other toys. Why can you not just everyone have a different toy? And then kids started to argue. And then one day I said, what do you think about taking away all the toys? Nothing there anymore.
Great, Carsten. Thanks for joining in. It's so good to have you here.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And Tiffany, welcome. It's, what is it, 9:30 at night? No, 8 o'clock at our time. I was thinking 9:30. I don't know which one am I in right now.
Were you dialing in from a different time zone?
Berlin, Basel. Everything starts with B.
Yeah, Carsten's in Basel. I was really looking forward to this call because of many reasons. You and I have known each other for the last 5 years, Carsten, or maybe more. And actually, the reason you're here on the show today is, as we speak, in a couple of months, you're going to pack your bags, sell all your belongings, and pack your stuff on your bike and travel to the infinity for 1.5 years. And not alone, with your family, with your wife and a 7-year-old kid. And that's amazing. And I was so envious when I heard that. And I said, I got to have you here. But obviously, the inspiration stems back even way longer. I've known you for 5 years. And the way you've run a little Kita group or play group with your kids while managing a busy day job and making sure your kid Anna is sort of self-sufficient, independent, and also playful has been really, really inspiring. We want to unpack all that stuff in today's episode. So thanks for joining in.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm looking forward to what question you've prepared for me.
So tell us about yourself, Carsten, just to paint a little bit of picture, and then we take it from there.
I grew up in Bavaria. I had a very lovely childhood there. My father was an eye doctor in the local city. And my mom, as many moms in the 80s, stayed at home. And school normally started at 8 and normally ended at 11:15 or 12:30, the latest. So at 1 o'clock, there was lunch together with mom and dad. And at 2, basically, I was free to do whatever I wanted to do. And I still remember that my parents then just said, okay, you have to be back at 6. So at 6, the church bell rang. And So we, for 4 hours, we kind of went into the forest and we weren't seen by anyone. And my mom also didn't know where exactly we are. And this was my childhood until I joined scouting at the age of 10, 11. And scouting brought a very new dimension to my life because it's not just about you. It's about being part of a team. And it's not about doing things for you, but it's also doing things for others, right? The good deed of the day and being there, servicing the community. That's something I really learned and also grew into up to that I then, at the age of 12, was responsible for 26 to 8-year-olds once a week running a group. The Scout movement here in Europe is a movement by children and young people for children and young people. And during the school time, I was very lucky that it wasn't very hard for me to get good grades and satisfy my parents from this perspective. I set up a little business which makes websites for local companies. So I started to set up websites at the age of 14 for a local driving school and a bakery and a dentist and whatever you have in a small village. And with that, I made money and I used the money to travel during the summertime. So when my other colleagues had to do summer jobs, I was backpacking and through Europe mainly. And by that way, learning a lot what travel does with you, right? When you dive into different cultures and when you learn different languages and you encounter situations which you're not used to. And this little business then made me interested in studying business. So I went to a business school close to Cologne and I had 4-year business studies where basically the idea was that you spend 2 years at university doing all the theory part. Then you spend 1 year at 2 different universities doing exchange semesters. And then you do 4 internships times 3 months. So I went to Sri Lanka and I became the assistant of the CEO of a local cement plant. And the CEO told me, your job is to find out why the cement bag out of the production site costs 480 rupees and the end user in the country pays 630. So where does this difference go? So usually the cement bag goes through 14 hands. And I then made a model where the cement bag would only go through 8 hands instead of 14. And we could lower the price of cement from 630 to 580 per bag, which allows the average Sri Lankan to build a house not in 5 years, but in 4 years. And this was the point where I asked myself, what is my responsibility as a business graduate? And what can business do? And business can, on the one hand, provide good materials at an affordable price, but business can also, and this happened in that case, not lower the price, but take out the 6 out of the 14, keep the price, and have a higher margin for the producer. And this then was something where I started to not feel well inside myself. And I said, why did I study business? So I ended up in my quarter life crisis at the age of like 23. And in order
I think it's a great time for a crisis, to be honest.
You think so? Yeah.
I think so. I think that with every crisis and it sounds like you're about to tell me all the things you learned from it. I like to learn hard and fast. Let's get it out of the way and make fewer mistakes as we go. So yeah, I think it's a great time for a crisis, if you must.
Yeah. I think for me, it was a very challenging time because you kind of feel like you spend 4 years at university studying something which in the end you don't want to work in a big corporate and do PowerPoint and Excel until you get retired. Mm-hmm. And I started then to do a PhD in innovation and technology management on the one hand to look a little bit what's behind business. And eventually I then found myself with a group of old scouting friends in Mongolia, where I then set up a scout exchange program with young people from Germany and young people from Mongolia. And out of this scout exchange program in 2009, we collected English books for Mongolian children because they asked for English books. And with these English books, we set up a learning center in a rural community in southern Mongolia, where basically the hook was that it's not a traditional donation project, but that actually the community starts teaching themselves in what they perceive as a need in education in the community. So like a self-help group, the best mechanic teaches the others how to fix a motorcycle. The best entrepreneur teaches others how to win tourists in the summer months to stay in gears and pay some money. And this principle we coined into like a business model, and the learning center immediately after 6 months broke even because people were so interested in the courses because it corresponded to their own needs. And they were really surprised that they could do this on their own and they didn't have to wait for, you know, the white man with the suitcase of money and the project plan coming. But basically everything was already there. And this was the moment where I then discovered my purpose in life, where I said, hey, I want to empower people to actually do what they really are. I want to make people aware that there's only one life and that it's worth to think about what purpose you use this life for. And to start acting rather than only being a slave of someone or sometimes a slave of yourself and your own behaviors. So today I'm a social entrepreneur where we work with deprived communities from around the world and help people to set up their own businesses, primarily for social, ecological, or also economic goals. And these businesses are owned by the community, for the community, and they are all financially self-sustained. And I've linked that with a leadership development program where every time such a community starts to develop a model, we have a group of professionals from Europe or also the United States joining a team of community members and co-creating a model for systemic change in the community. And by that way, these professionals learn how to think and act as entrepreneurs, how to lead with purpose. And also they learn that business is not just about making money, but about being a responsible leader and making a difference.
Yeah. And that's the genesis of Bookbridge, which is a company you've run for the last few years, run on the principle of making these communities self-sustainable, independent, and just kind of not telling them where they need help, but helping themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And reaching out and creating those models with the help of people from this region. Mm-hmm. I'm actually tempted to jump to this part, which we might have skipped.
I'm not letting you jump. I have a question. So I find that, first of all, that's so incredible. But I also have to look back at that time in Scouts And this is something that I'm not really familiar with. So you said that the kids, the older kids, are leading the younger kids. So I imagine, I mean, not only does that develop your own independence, but we learn through teaching as well. And so I'm curious, what types of activities or, yeah, what types of things were you doing as scouts with these younger kids? And so you just, do you feel like this, I mean, I'm sure that this really developed problem-solving skills and just gives a person this idea that they actually don't need somebody else or an adult or a white man with a suitcase to figure it out, that you feel like you can find the solutions. Do you think that was a part of shaping how you ended up, or that it gave you a lot of skills that helped you achieve those things? Yeah, definitely.
So as a Cub Scout leader, basically, on the one hand, you have a weekly meeting where you and normally someone else, same age as you, around 12, 13, you have a group of 15 to 20, 6 to 8-year-olds. And if there's a forest around, you normally go outside. You do most of the things outside. But there's also, especially in wintertime, scout groups which then meet inside. So that's one part, the weekly meetings. But the other part is really then going traveling. So you have then 15 to 20 people with a backpack, and you start hiking somewhere, setting up a tent and staying there for 2-3 nights. For some of them, being this the first time ever, they are away from home. And actually, it helps a lot that there's a lot of fellow then kids at the same age, but also you are of course for them much older, but still.
And how old are you when you were leading these?
Well, 12, right? Yeah.
This is so mind blowing for an American.
I know. So
incredible.
I also attended some Boy Scout of America meetings in the United States, and I saw that this is more like the dad with the pickup truck and the barbecue going to a lake, and there is the son and the dad do barbecue, and the son kind
accurate.
Of so, yeah. So it's very different. And not saying that it's bad, it's just very different. I was very surprised, and most likely as surprised as you are now hearing this. And so the way scouting is practiced differs from country to country. And with the age of 13, we were a group of, I think, 10 scouts being aged between like 13 to 17. And we went on our own to Sweden for a 4-week trip.
No
way. So we had to manage our own money and, I mean, all the train rides and everything. And I was at the age of 13, I was responsible for the whole budget of the group for 4 weeks. And at that time, there was no credit card. You had cash with you. And that kind of shaped me a lot and told me, on the one hand, gave me a lot of self-confidence.
Mm-hmm. I imagine.
And you felt trusted. And this is something I'm now also handing over to my daughter, trusting her and saying her, hey, you can do this. If you want to ride the tram in the morning to your school, you can do it.
Did you guys eat a ton of candy with you as treasurer? I mean, I know you were very responsible, but come on. Were you guys buying, like, were you eating really healthy food, or was it like, we have candy money?
Of course.
Responsible?
Hey, you know, scouting is also about eating ice cream and eating cake. And so I think that's part of life. But of course, I mean, once you, and that's something I also see with, for example, giving money to Anna. Every Tuesday, we go to the Unwrapped store in Basel and we fill our glasses with what we need for the week in terms of food. And she always pays for her own little glass of sweets. So she has one glass which she can fill with whatever she wants. And she's looking at this very responsibly, right? And she has her own purse and her own money. And she learns that this is worth something, that not just daddy is swiping the card and then it's bought, but that I have these coins and every week I need to give some coins to this person in order to get my glass refilled.
I love that. That's incredible.
I would love to know your parents. What is their role in how you're doing this with Anna and how you're nurturing her to be responsible and independent and by herself? How was your childhood like with your parents?
If you ask my mother today what she observes about me parenting Anna, then she says, well, you really spend a lot of quality time with your daughter. And she's very happy about this. So every Sunday, normally, Anna and I, we go hiking. We usually go to a location now around Basel, anything 20, 30 minutes by bike. And then you just start walking for 5-6 hours.
She would walk for 5-6 hours at the age of 7?
Someone actually told me, a doctor told me, a kid at the age of 7 can walk for 6 to 7 hours without any problem. And when I started hiking with Anna, I only noticed the first half an hour to 1 hour was very challenging for her. But then once there was a certain point of time crossed, she would just walk. And I mean, there's so much you discover along the way. It's not walking 4 kilometers an hour for 6 hours, but maybe in the end, total kilometer is maybe 10 or 12. But, you know, there's maybe a castle and you play in the castle, or you find a little animal and then you start looking where the animal comes from or goes to. Then you sit down and you have a lunch. So I want Anna basically to experience nature just like I experienced nature in my childhood. And we have a constraint. We live in a bigger city than I grew up in, but still the forest is 10 minutes by bike. So you cannot walk there, but she has to kind of take the bike. That's why regularly, twice a week, we go to the forest.
Nice.
I love that. We, a couple years ago, went to Harz. Mm-hmm. And with my daughter, and she was, I want to say 9, and it was a really long hike. I mean, it was truly the entire day, and she had never done anything like that before. And I, at the beginning, there was a lot of whining, a little resistance. Are we there yet? You know, all the typical kid things that you get. But along the way, she started to get lost in things, and we were going off the path and found a little creek and stacking some rocks. And yeah, there are all these things to find along the way. And at the end of it, she was so proud that she made it to the top, and so many other kids in her class, she was going back to the US and telling them about this very long hike that she was on. And you know, everybody said, what? She really walked that long? And she did. And I mean, she was so proud. And when I look back, it's probably one of our favorite vacations or activities that we've ever done on vacation.
This is an interesting segue, because I think you've structured your work life, your day life, in a beautiful way, which makes enough room for quality time with Anna. And I noticed that like a few years back, you know, I used to... I don't know if you remember, but you know, we used to set up meetings, and if I missed an appointment or somehow you had to let go, the next appointment I would find like 3 or 4 weeks later in your calendar. And then when I would say, hey, Carson, when can we meet, you know, next week? Like, I don't work these days. I don't work after this hours. And I'm like, this is really strange. Something's up here. And it took me a while to figure out that you had to create a lot of structure around your schedule and boundaries to make time for wonderful things and quality stuff. I would love to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what Deep is describing sounds a lot like boundaries. And this is, I think, not always so easy for people. I think a lot of people do want to spend more time with their kids and quality time, and maybe they struggle to find those. So how were you able to do it and, you know, stick with it so much?
Yeah, actually, the birth of my daughter changed a lot in the way how I live my life. So I think my social enterprise, Bookbridge, offers really super leadership development programs, but my daughter is actually the best leadership program in the world you can take. And before she was born, I basically spent 4 to 5 months of the year out of the country, in Mongolia, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, or another country. And my wife and me, we've been together now for 20 years. So we had really a long history together. And that's why also our relationship sustained, you know, all these travels. But when Anna was born, I really asked myself, what kind of dad do I want to be? Do I want to be the dad who only shows up on Sunday? Or do I really want to be their caring father? And my decision was that for 1 year after she got born, I would not fly. And my decision was also that I take 4 months off to support my wife, because for both of us, this was a new phase of life. And I still remember, on the one hand, you know, handing over all these responsibilities within my team that the business could continue, and then really enjoying seeing my daughter being born and accompanying my wife on every little step. And then actually really getting into what I say, like a roller coaster of, I mean, in, for everything here, you have a license. You have a driving license, you have a swimming license, you have a diving license. But when a kid is born, after 3 days, they throw you out of the hospital and they tell you, now it's yours, have fun. Right?
Yeah, they just give that to you.
Right? There's no license, there's nothing. So I'm saying, hey, okay, what do I do? What do I do? And I felt like very bad, like an assistant. I was changing diapers and cooking and cleaning. And my wife was really busy breastfeeding and then taking her to sleep. And Anna was also a kid who every 1.5 hours she wanted to be fed, even at night. So it was very, very difficult at the beginning, also for my wife to catch any sleep. Mm. And I felt after 4 months, I thought, I cannot go back to work. This won't work. She needs me. So I wrote my team and I said, hey, I have to stay a couple of months longer. This is very difficult, right? And then my team said, Carsten, you have to come back. You cannot just stay at home until the end of your life. And then I went back to work, but not 100%, but I started like 60%, I think. And I still know the first day I went to the office, I thought, no, my wife will die, bro. She will not be very happy about this. And in the end, it worked. I think it's always like the challenge you set yourself. Then you find a way. And out of the 1 year not flying, in the end, it turned to be 2.5 years not flying. And this had a big message to all my team members, because the way how you set up your social enterprises and deprived communities, which run by themselves, we can also sustain without Carsten having to travel for 2 weeks to Mongolia and 3 weeks to Cambodia. And that sent a big signal also to my team that in the end, it's about being an entrepreneur and being independent. And through this, I was then able to slowly, year by year, get more time freed up in my calendar to then be with Anna and also look at what I think is important when a child grows up today, like in 2013 when she was born. Mm-hmm. And at that time, a lot of parents basically used to either stay at home, like usually the mother stays at home. Here in Basel, we have a few examples of dad staying at home, but usually it's the mother. And here in Switzerland, kindergarten only starts at the age of 5. And then many moms stay at home until the kid is 5. And then they start working part-time. And all the dads then work full-time, right? They have to pay all the bills. So I thought, how can we design a system which like balances this out and allows my wife to go back to work and allows me to work while we still take care of Anna? And we figured out from the start that Kita is not what we want, because you pay in Switzerland a ridiculously high amount of money. It can go up to 2,500 euros a month to have your child being put into a Kita. And then you go to work and you earn 3,000. So then you think, okay, you know, all the money basically I earn, I'm putting into this Kita. And
for strangers to raise your child.
Strangers who raise the kid which you made. I mean, so yeah. And then I think, hey, this doesn't feel good. And this was the moment where we then started to reach out to other families. We produced leaflets and we said, hey, we want to set up a little playing group with about 5 to 6 children.
Yeah.
And we want to share babysitting. And we started then to call that Nestrocker in Swiss German, which means a rock band in a little bird's nest. And we had 5 families, really interesting. One from Japan, one from Argentina, one from France, one from Germany, one from Switzerland.
Oh, wow.
One kid each, all the same.
Multiculti to the max. I love it.
And we decided then to run this playing group in our apartment, because one family had to commit to provide their space for cooking and then also for sleeping. So, and it was always 2 adults with 5 kids. And you can imagine now 5 kids lying here in our bed. And we then figured out, hey, spending time in the apartment is not a good idea. We need to go out. So most of the time we spent in the forest or in the park. And when kids did not have like something to play with, toys, but they had to find a stone and something else to play with, everything was fine. As soon as there was only one toy available, they started to get into fights or who is allowed to play with this toy. So we started like a toy-free playing group, basically. And I read a lot about what this means take away all the toys with your kids. So the kids pack the toys and then we send them somewhere and then suddenly they're gone. And then they start playing with a chair, which becomes a spaceship, and a blanket, which becomes a house. So mm-hmm. you foster their imagination, their creativity, and they start to invent stories. And now, 6 years later, I still have a playing group with four kids every Wednesday afternoon in the forest. And what do these kids do? They just take a stick, they invent a story, and they play for hours, which, in you know, the way how I was raised, I think I would have found this very hard because we were given a lot of toys in the 80s. For everything, there was like a toy. And this is what I think then also prepares Anna for life, because in the end, she needs to have then skills in the future which cannot be replaced by a robot. And so far, robots don't tell stories.
That's really fantastic.
Yeah, I just wish that more of us could just come together and beat this whole kindergarten scarcity that we have here in Berlin. It's just such a nicer way to manage stuff. What did you follow for, you know, you mentioned about toy-free playing. Were you following certain coaches or certain books or certain methods of doing that? Or was it just intuitive, whatever came to you?
Yeah, it was intuitive, Deep. So it was not that we read a book, How to Raise a Child. We had books when Anna was ill where we then looked, okay, what can we do? But for us, we followed basically our experience. So we saw that the kids were fighting around toys. So we took away the toys with them. And we started first, not before taking away the toys, we started to talk to them and say, why are you all interested in that very same toy? There's other toys. Why can you not just everyone have a different toy? And then kids started to argue. And then one day I said, what do you think about taking away all the toys? Nothing there anymore. And then the kids...
You make it sound so magical when there's like a movie about it and it's called The Grinch That Stole Christmas.
That's a great idea. So I went into the basement, I got a big box and we packed all the toys. And then I asked, to whom should we give these toys? So we wrote big Santa Claus on the box and the box was gone. The toys were gone. And the kids only realized, I think, and like half an hour later, all toys were gone. And then they had to start to develop another way of playing. And as I said, the chair became the spaceship and the blanket became the house. And that is something where in the end you realize all these materialistic thinking and things we have in our homes is something which destroys creativity and which also makes the child passive. Mm-hmm. Rather than active. Mm-hmm. And only a few years later, when we started actually to move to preschool, we started to think about, okay, what alternatives do we have to the government-run preschools? And then I started to look into a Waldorf kindergarten, and I started to mm-hmm. look into a Montessori kindergarten. And then I found out that Montessori was closest to the way how we had been raising Anna. And that's why she then went into a Montessori kindergarten.
Incredible. Still, I thought I was so progressive, not letting Olive have devices for this very reason. It stunts creativity and they become very passive. And now I'm thinking, do I need to go into her room and just take all the things out, like all the toys out, throw some sticks in there? Yeah.
Do it.
I'm going to tell her you told me to, Deep. So just remember that next time you see her.
Janusz's ESA list goes down by like 50% already.
Yeah, painted sticks. That's what we're doing now.
Yeah,
I love it. I think that's actually incredible. And my daughter was also in a Montessori preschool. And I also read about it and the way these children develop and their creativity and how what they also do is they learn how to learn.
Yeah, and they participate in everyday life. So, for example, one key activity I was always doing with the kids here in the playgroup when they were like 2 or 3 years old, once a week I was baking bread with them.
Oh. Right?
And they were doing the dough and they really enjoyed it. They were washing the dishes, putting the dishes onto the table. And when I then went into a Montessori kindergarten without knowing what Montessori is, I then also saw kids baking, washing the dishes. So I thought, oh, hey, it's really cool that this is not like an adult teacher doing, but this is actually the kids running their own show. And there's actually no teacher. Mm-hmm. There is people who are there in case a kid has a question or a special need, but there is no like show run for kids, like, which is what I observed in the preschools here in Switzerland, that there's a very stiff curriculum, and that kids already at the age of five, then they start to solve mathematical problems, and they need to sit on a chair for like 1 hour, where I thought, hey, this is not my kid and this is not fun. And that's why we were very happy that we found this kindergarten, that Anna also liked it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I would love to hear about what took you from, I mean, so you guys are going on this bike trip. How did you decide this, and where are you going? And I want to hear about this, because I'm sure there are some things you guys had to consider. When you have a child in your home, they just become a part of your life and your family. So I can also see how, yeah, well, sure, we just take her with us. But not everyone is doing that. So what is it about you guys, and what led you to this decision to say, no, we are all going on this bike trip together?
The first time we started to think about it was January last year, so pre-corona. There are three reasons. One is that my wife and I, we have been together for more than 20 years, and we really love each other. And we thought that it would be good to put in front of us another challenge where we can grow also individually, but also as a couple. And past challenges, I mean, Anna, of course, is one of these challenges we decided to. But other than that, you know, it was always in the past someone moving to someone's place because there was work or some other opportunity. So we thought it's good that we do something which, you know, is not linked to work or to someone's needs, but something neutral to grow our relationship. So that was the first reason. Second, I went with Anna to Mongolia 2 years ago. For 3 months, we took the Trans-Siberian Railways through Russia for 1 month, and then we went camel, horse, and reindeer trekking for 3 months in Mongolia. And I saw how Anna grew in her interest in foreign cultures, in her interest in languages, in her self-confidence. So that I thought, wow, this has given a big boost to Anna. It would be good to kind of do things like this more often. So that's why we thought, hey, when Anna maybe is now 11 or 12, she would say, hey, I have my friends, I have my life. I will not go with you for 1.5 years on a bicycle trip. Maybe I join you for 3 months and then I go back. And now is a good point of time where she's now in first grade. I mean, it's mostly about high German and mathematics, something we are also capable of doing, or she can repeat all this when she comes back to school. So we thought this is a good point of time. And Anna was also for it. Right? We discussed it very openly with her. Do you want to leave for 1.5 years, which is...
What did she say?
A long time. And she said, yeah, I'm ready. When do we leave?
Dad, tomorrow.
and because we had done like bicycle trips, 3-4 week bicycle trips in the summer holidays before. So she knows what it means to be on a bicycle. And the third reason was actually my business, that when I set it up as a foundation, so it's a for impact organization, I said that on the one hand, I want to set up an organization which is financially self-sustained, so which can, you know, sustain its own operations. So we achieved that 4 years after setting it up. And the other one was that I set up an organization which can be independently run from me, so that I'm not needed anymore. Not in a way that I want to leave. This is my life purpose I have put into this. But at the same time, I also know that the founder sometimes stands in the way of certain developments. And at the same time, it's good to, after 10 years, take a sabbatical, refresh your batteries, gain new insights, and then come back. And these three reasons, so my wife, our relationship, Anna, perfect development opportunity, and then also Bookbridge, I thought this is a good opportunity to leave. And then we made the decision in October last year that we want to leave as of July. So July 1st, we're going to start, and we will have a tandem bicycle. So Katharina and I will be on one bicycle, and then Anna, she can either be hooked up onto the tandem bicycle, or she can also ride her own bicycle. And it's the three of us riding. And the idea is to have no plan. So
love that.
instead of planning where to go, we said deliberately, we will have no plan. So we will decide on July 1st. Maybe it's a super sweat, hot day, 35 degrees. And then we might say, let's go higher up in the Alps and let's stay there for some weeks until temperatures cool down. But it could also be that we say, no, maybe let's start riding towards the ocean. So I really like this kind of freedom.
Wait, so you guys are really just riding from home? Like just leaving home one morning and then not coming back for a year and a half or so?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And I have some questions.
Many questions. Reset the clock, guys.
I'm just going to rewind a second. What? And like my mom brain is like, what are you packing to eat even just like for that first leg? And if you don't know where you're going. And I mean, I think that's so cool and that's awesome. But surely you are preparing in some ways. Yes.
Who's a planner, first of all, between the two?
Yeah, is it? Yeah.
It's interesting. It's at the beginning, it has been a lot me because I've been used to doing such trips. Mm-hmm. But now it's actually my wife and me, both of us. And on the planning stage, on the one hand, you need to terminate your apartment contract, terminate your insurances, terminate all the subscriptions you have. And on the other hand, it's about making a packing list. What do we take with us? What do we do with all the things we have here? So there is pre-work, but we've always lived like on a small footprint, so to say. Mm-hmm. So my parents at my age, they had like a big house and I don't know how many rooms and a big garden and a lot to do. Mm-hmm. I think for them, they didn't even think about this. But for us, you know, it's easy to give up a rented apartment. And then when you come back, you rent another one, right?
Mm-hmm. This is Are you guys planning to come back to the same area?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I have been engaged for the last 3 years in setting up a co-op, cooperative housing project here in Basel.
Okay.
Where it's actually just a new building being built opposite to where we live. It's 45 apartments, 145 people. And the idea is that each apartment is smaller, so everyone gives up personal space. And you have a lot of community space, like you have a cantina, a restaurant, where
you
cook for everyone. You have a bar, you have a yoga room, you have a music room, you have a room with a lot of tools. And in addition, there is a farm which supplies all the food you consume to the people in the co-op.
By
that way, we want to reduce the ecological footprint. So it's an idea of living together, a community housing project, but at the same time also living in an ecologically friendly way. And that will be ready in like spring 2023, so about 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. So we thought, hey, this is cool to bridge this time.
Perfect, yeah.
And take a considerably big period, because if you only leave for 3 months, like I left for Mongolia, I felt I had to prepare a lot to leave. And then I left and then I came back and I usually delete all my emails during holidays. So when you send me an email, there's an autoresponder coming back. Your email has been deleted. I will be back on September 1st. Feel free to contact me then.
That's a life hack. Oh my God, that's incredible.
By that way, you have an empty mailbox. And of course, there is a contact. So if they have something urgent, they can contact someone else. But you're not confronted with 2,800 emails after like 3 months or whatever. And
my whole life's about to change. When we hang up, my whole life is going to change.
it's forever delete mode.
And we have to find what is a good period of time to take time off so that I don't have to think about whether I do something tomorrow, next week, or next month. And I then thought something between 1 and 2 years would be ideal. Mm-hmm. So that's how we came up with these 1.5 years. And what it will be at the end, we don't know. The idea is that we cycle, but that we also stop at certain places where we like to stop. Maybe we find projects or farms where we can engage and stay a little longer. So it's not about making a certain mileage, but it's really about being on travels, right?
That's incredible. And as far as where you guys are planning on staying, are you taking things to camp? Are you planning to find places to stay or Airbnbs?
So we said it's about one third tent, mm-hmm. one third youth hostels, warm showers, Airbnb, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then one third where we really stay at a fixed place and we maybe even have a job, something we can contribute. And we join a community, right? This could be like an olive farm in Greece, or it could be like a project with disabled children somewhere in Slovenia or whatever, mm-hmm. right? I'm very much aware that volunteers take away jobs of locals, so that's not something we want to do. But mm-hmm. I'm also aware that I have certain skills which might be beneficial to the one or the other. And I'm sure that on the way, I will recognize opportunities and then just take them as they come.
What are the non-negotiables, like things that you would not do or you wouldn't trade off in this? It's a pretty big trip, right? So there's certain things that you would agree that, okay, I'm not going to do that. Like not stay in hotels.
Aha. Uh-huh. So not fly. That's one thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we don't experience joy, it could be that maybe after like 2-3 months, we say, hey, this, we thought this would be joyful, but it's actually awkward. Then we return. And the same thing, if one of us kind of suffers from bad health, then we also return.
Mm.
But other than that, we are free, right? And with a tent and a cooker, you can stay anywhere and you live off like 5 to 10 euros a day. You just need to have food. That's all.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
What I'm wondering is for both of you to come together and plan this as a family, that's an achievement. That's a feat in itself.
So interestingly, there has so much happened in our relationship, but also individually in our development since we took this decision that I already said like 2-3 months ago, even if we don't go, it was already worth planning. because of course you start to ask questions. You start to, like my wife, she quit her job. And then suddenly people turned to her and gave her feedback, wonderful feedback, and told her, hey, how courageous she is. And she would have never gotten that feedback if she hadn't quit it, which is really sad. And for me, then seeing my dream fulfilled that I'm not needed anymore in my organization, but then really suffering, really being very sad, like having tears in my eyes suddenly. I don't have a meeting anymore. I only get 2 emails a day. This is, you know, you feel like, okay, and it's still like 4 months to go until we leave, right? So it's really interesting also psychologically where you go through. And this was already totally worth it. And we haven't even left.
Wow. This must be some kind of like, this feels like some kind of like relationship gladiator contest. Like, well, we have done so many things. We have been such a successful relationship. Like, what else could we try? Like, let's just quit our jobs, leave our places.
All right. I think one big objective I have with this trip is to develop more empathy and more self-love. Mm-hmm. And on a bike, you are very vulnerable. You're vulnerable to any car or any traffic passing by, but you're also vulnerable to the weather. Imagine it starts raining like hell. Mm-hmm. And my experience is the more vulnerable you show yourself to others, the more open they are. And the more you realize that you live in a world where you can go wherever you want to. If you're open, if you open up yourself, others will open up towards you. And this is something I would like to hand over to my daughter, Anna, as a feeling and as something she realizes that we are all stuck in that box. And leaving this box only takes a bicycle, which I think I would say like 90% of us have a bicycle at home. And taking a tent and a mattress might not be everyone's thing. You can also stay in a hotel or in a youth hostel or a pension. But still, it's something where I realized same thing like with Bookbridge, where I started to collect books for Mongolia, where everyone said, I could also do this. I could also collect books. That's easy. And then you develop another idea out of it. It's the same thing, right? You start with a bicycle. And let's see what develops out of this. So we don't know. But we know that through this, we will reach a different level of consciousness towards ourselves, towards us as partners, And also for Anna, it will be broadening her horizon and it will teach her so many things more, which she can then use to walk her own path of life.
Beautiful.
What else can you say? I mean, that really, I feel like that's so, yeah, it's beautiful. But I love it. I love it. I have no further questions. I'm speechless.
You can join us July 1st. Come with your bicycle to Basel. And then we start riding. I mean, very easy, right? So it's not something hard.
Are you recording this trip? And are you sort of inviting people over to join in some segments of your trips?
Deep. We got to get our families. We should do this. If Carson is, yes, Carson, can we come? Can we meet you?
So, what I will do is invite people to leave me their email address. And then when we are maybe every 1 to 2 months, we will just send an email with an update on what we have been doing and attaching 2 free pictures. But what we will not be doing is blogging or Instagramming or whatever. Because then in the end, you find yourself in this moment of silence and peace. And then suddenly there is ding. Oh, yeah, I need still to upload. Oh, I still need to write this blog post. And we said, no, this is like an investment into ourselves and not into the internet. Still, if there is like places where we stay longer, so imagine maybe we stay at a farm in Slovenia or in Greece for 4 to 6 weeks, we would just then send the address and whoever wants to come for a visit is invited to come for a visit.
I'm down for that. You got 2 subscribers today, Carson.
Yeah, that's good.
That would be incredible.
Oh. Yeah, Carson, it was nice to have you.
It was nice to have you. Thank you.
It was such a pleasure to meet you, Carson. I absolutely loved and enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Hey guys, we hope you're enjoying the show. If you haven't already, head over to reroutingpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. Subscribers receive exclusive updates from Deep and I and are the first to know when there's a new episode out. That's reroutingpod.com. Enter your email and we'll make sure you don't miss a thing.